friends, welcome to Wings Neighborhood. I'm Varsha Vaishampayan, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host Rupa Bhandarkar. Our guest today is Subha Berry. Subha had a long, outstanding career in financial services for almost 3 decades. She has taught gender policy at Columbia University. She is a celebrated D&I leader and now the president at Working Mother Media. Subha is also a first-generation immigrant, raised 2 children, and as a true warrior, being a 6 times cancer survivor. It is my honor to welcome Subha to our hood. Today, Subha talks to us about how she overcame cultural barriers and biases as a first-generation immigrant while making sure that she stays true to herself. She says men and women leaders both must learn when to pull out the tough and bold side of you and when to be empathetic, nurturing, emotional self. A good leader knows how to do both. We will also hear her break the myth of work and life balance, talk about the importance of women supporting women, and leading with generosity of spirit. Finally, we press Subha on some tough questions, like are CEOs checking the box when it relates to diversity? Subha, very welcome to Wings Neighborhood. I want to start by saying, Subha, that you spent most of your career as a diversity and inclusion leader, and diversity is in the air right now. This is a very timely discussion. I remember a quote from John F. Kennedy. He said, "A rising tide lifts all boats." But we're at the bottom. So it's going to take a long, long lift. I just want to share, I think this is the data that we all have seen. But just to set the stage, I'll share this data and then we'll make the point. Between February and August, mothers of children 12 years and older lost 2.2 million jobs compared to 870,000 jobs lost by fathers. It's even worse for women of color, as 6.4% of Black mothers have left the workforce compared to 2.4% of white mothers. Now, that's one side of the story. There is another side of the story. On the other hand, we have 37 women CEOs of Fortune 500 companies in 2020. 126 women hold seats in the United States Congress, comprising of 23.6% of the 535 members. And also, first woman to be a Secretary of the Treasury, which I'm very excited about. So you see, Subha, we make 2 steps forward and 3 steps backward. I want to drill a little bit more into this topic and ask you, what do you think about the current environment? Government, politics, business, everyone is focused on the agenda of equality, gender and racial. What lessons did we learn? What else we need to do to move forward so that we don't slip backwards so much?
So Varsha and Rupa, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I think that, you know, it's almost like the tale of two cities. On one side, you're starting to see women, by the way, the number is 40 now, with Roz Brewer being appointed the CEO of Walgreens Boots Alliance. She is the number 40 woman CEO of a major Fortune 500 company. It's remarkable the progress that's been made, and that in spite of a few of them dropping out, retiring, et cetera, like Indira Nooyi retired and so on. And you talked about the women in Congress. If you look at boards, every S&P 500 company now has a woman board member. So there is not one exception. So there are positives on that side. And yet, the reason I think of it as the tale of two cities is you have women in the workforce struggling at every level. So when you talk about working parents, they struggle in their own unique ways. And one would think that, well, dads and moms are both home, so why would moms sort of take up that disproportionate burden? But the reality is that's what's happening. And it doesn't matter even if you chose wisely and married a spouse that was most supportive. When it comes to home and taking care of the kids, and especially homeschooling and the likes, it appears that women are bearing a disproportionate share of that burden. Yeah. And if you have children that are in grade school and younger, it is even more complex. Okay. So I read data that said that working moms are interrupted on an average 15 times an hour. Just imagine, how can you get any work done if you're interrupted that frequently? Okay. So I think that on one side, you have all of the amazing skill sets that women bring to the mix. Imagine, for example, if you looked at the hardest hit countries for COVID, and then you looked at which countries came out of it quickly and really well. Yeah. Such a large percentage of them were led by women leaders, from Angela Merkel to Jacinda at New Zealand. So the reality is, I personally believe that women have some innate leadership qualities and skills that lend itself to really excelling during a time of crisis. Okay? When you think about that and you say to yourself, women are empathetic, they prioritize really well, they multitask effectively, they use data to help guide their decision-making process, they are, in my opinion, smarter, better risk takers than men. So in so many ways, women were actually made for dealing with crises. Because when you think about our lives and how we sort of manage and juggle all these things, we are really innately better. And yet, if you take extra burden and put it on these women while they have to deal with all this, you know, how can you expect them to come out of this any better? So as a result, what you're seeing is women having to do so much more on the home front. And then when you look at single family households, disproportionately led by women, many of them women of color, you ask yourself, how do you even cope and manage with this? I really believe it's the tale of two cities. We have made progress on one side, but that progress is as a result of all of the hard work we've done over the last 5, 6, 7 years. But what is happening right now and here is that women are buckling under the weight of the stress and the physical amount of responsibilities that they have to take on. And I will speak for communities of color, specifically with the Asian community, where acknowledging mental stress or inability to cope with that is something that you just don't talk about. You essentially have to suck it up and bear it. And so the reality is, believe it or not, that same burden falls disproportionately within even Hispanic and Black communities. Talking about mental stress, mental challenges, etc., is something people expect you to figure out how to cope with it. Yeah. So they don't seek help. And when they don't seek help, think about what happens.
And two other qualities that I think you probably already mentioned were really great problem solvers and networking. Think about a mom who is supporting work and 3 children and school and PTA and support system is how they get it all done.
That's exactly right. And the reality is we have all those skills. And guess what? Many women are using those on the work front, which is why I say to women, almost keep a crisis journal. Start to note down things that you are doing day to day so that at the end, you can look at it at the end of every week, every month, sit down and catalog all of those things that you did while you were juggling all these different things that you dealt with. And you should actually be able to go speak to your boss about how you accomplished that. That should be the basis of you getting your next promotion, your raise, and so on. So don't be embarrassed about maintaining that crisis journal that can catalog what you're going through. And to me, what's really interesting about it, Varsha and Rupa, is that women just do it so innately. We do it naturally. And in fact, we are uncomfortable with actually documenting it. We don't feel like that's something we should actually brag about. I'm going to say to you, we should be doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. Exactly that.
Yeah.
I love the idea of the crisis journal that you mentioned.
Isn't it? It's like you have lemons, make lemonade with it.
Exactly. And
so the other piece that to me is really disconcerting is we did 3 surveys during the course of the pandemic. One we did right at the start of the pandemic. One we did right when the kids went back to school. And then one we did more recently. Each of them said the same thing that really disappointed us, that even when both parents were working from home, even when they are dual career households and both parents are at home, the women, not only are they doing more on the home front, But the kind of consideration they're getting shown by their managers and their companies is also disproportionately lower than what men are getting. Men are asked, you know, should we look at your workload? Do you need more flexibility? Do you need to take time off? What can we do to help you? Men are getting that almost 2-to-1 what women are in terms of that consideration being shown by their company and by their bosses. And, you know, one would expect that that would innately or naturally happen more so for women than men, but it isn't happening.
Yeah,
so true. I like the idea that you mentioned about the crisis journal. I recently switched jobs and, you know, I had started maintaining an ideas journal from the time I mentioned, but now I'm going to start maintaining a crisis journal as well. You know, everything that you mentioned, Subha, you know, several things come to mind. You mentioned this fact about women having innate leadership skills and certain things that we do, but, you know, men getting an additional consideration in the current times as well for what they're doing versus less consideration for women. I make it a point for many of my male colleagues or direct reports or just men in general, when they say they're babysitting their kids, I said, you know, you're just taking care of your kids. You're not babysitting your kids while your wife is away. And it's just, not that that itself is going to change mindsets, but again, just, you know, words have power and the language that that is used as well. But two things come to mind as you mentioned the tale of two cities. One, in terms of, you know, you mentioned the women of color and the additional stigma that is associated with mental health and so on. And this whole, you know, things that come to mind are on the first generation immigrant, and we will come to that point. I'm very keen to get your insights on that. But before going there, I wanted to also talk a little bit about the fact that you mentioned both companies and countries have fared very well. Those have been led by women, like the ones that you mentioned. And it is due to some of these innate leadership skills, the risk-taking ability, smart risk-taking, and all of that. There's been a spotlight on that. I think we've seen some out in the media, some, you know, talk around that. Do you see a true culture shift happening right now with the momentum that's there, with the shining examples that are there, companies' overall culture changing because of what's happened and some of these things coming to the forefront? And I almost wonder, you know, just like women are being told or have been told over the years, you know, be more confident, be more aggressive like men, and all the coaching that happens, are men going to be asked to be more empathetic and be more collaborative like women and be more empathetic, et cetera? How do you see this momentum picking up and really bringing about true culture change?
So there are a couple of things happening on the corporate front where I would say to you, largely driven by all of the sort of racial awakening that has happened in this country and around the world, increasingly you are finding that leaders who didn't think that they should be commenting on this or speaking to it are being pushed by their employees to actually make a statement about it, which means that you have to be able to show that more vulnerable, empathetic side of yourself. And leaders who probably would never have spoken or let that side of them be seen are suddenly being made to be more comfortable with doing that. Okay, so what has that done? And in many ways, we used to talk about that as being touchy-feely, you know? And all of a sudden, male leaders are finding that they need to be a little touchy-feely. So I think that those qualities that used to be thought of as feminine qualities, male qualities were bold and, you know, taking risk and, you know, climbing that mountain or having a vision and being able to share it, almost like a general during an army, you know, during a war in the army. Women were much more thought of as collaborative. I'm listening to everybody. I hear about what you have to say. They would still make the decision in the end, but somehow they were never given credit for the fact that they took everybody's views into account before they came up with that decision. So I would say to you, to me, what's surprising and very positive is the fact that increasingly, men are beginning to value these traditionally feminine qualities. And in that happening, we are starting to see a transformation where companies are starting to talk about stakeholder capitalism instead of shareholder capitalism, where the obligation of the company is not just to their shareholders, but to employees, but to vendors, but to customers, but to the community around them, even the environment. So this notion that stakeholder capitalism can really become sort of the going forward mantra means all of those qualities that women more naturally and innately bring to the table, men are going to try to emulate. So guess what? Let us continue to hold on to what was our innate strength and make sure that we are able to express, share that, maybe inspire and teach some of these men how to do that better.
Fantastic. Love it.
There's nothing wrong in men being feminist.
It's not just being feminist. I used to say that the best leader was one where you knew when to pull out that masculine side of you and when to pull out that more feminine side of you. Same thing goes for women. A good leader is one who knows how to do both. It doesn't mean that most of us have both qualities, and we usually lead with one because that's our innate strength. I think a good leader is one who knows when to pull out which one.
Right. And I think, you know, the whole, it's becoming a more safe space and a comfortable space, not comfortable, but, you know, more leaders getting comfortable demonstrating both sides of that. I think that's great to see some of that balance coming about.
It is happening, and you're starting to see that. Like, I remember Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, stepping up to speak about, and I think that that's so powerful, so powerful.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And to round up what you said, the first part of your response in terms of immigrants and women of color, you have been a very outspoken advocate, you've been also very outspoken about your experiences as a first generation immigrant. Varsha and I are ourselves first generation immigrants, and we can relate to a lot of it. But would love to hear, what does that really mean to you, not just at work, but also on the home front, like you touched upon very briefly. And as first generation immigrants, we have accents, we could have language barriers, cultural differences, but this is what makes us who we are. And what advice would you have, Subha, for women who may feel the pressure to suppress some of that in order to fit in and be accepted? What would you say to them in terms of balancing authenticity while also, you know, fitting in some ways?
So that's a great question. I have to tell you that when you first come to this country, my name is a two-syllable name, Subha, okay? They would shorten it to Sue. And I did not at that point in time have the confidence and courage to say to them, no, it's Subha. I let it be. And in fact, at some point in time, I would refer to myself as Sue. So there was that one side of it where you do want to fit in. And, you know, this was long before I came here in the early 80s. You didn't have flat irons. I don't even think I had a hair dryer. So my hair was frizz city most of the time. Okay. So I always used to say, if nothing else gave me away, my frizzy hair gave me away. I did have a pronounced accent. I didn't know anything about the popular culture in this country. See, they didn't have television in India till I was 18. And even when they did, they had all these farming shows and things like that. So I really did not have, like, if you go to India now, you can watch most of the shows that are on TV here. It shows up there. I didn't have that. So I knew very little about this. I came here a complete rookie. Okay. I dressed differently. I ate differently. I looked different. Everything about me was different. But there was one advantage that I had that I didn't realize it at that time, but I realized it with time. And that was, I had grown up as part of the majority population. I grew up an Indian in India. So when I looked up, the movie stars were people who looked like me. I mean, much nicer looking, but they looked like me. I looked at doctors. I looked at business leaders. I looked at artists. I looked at everybody. They looked like me. And so I was never made to feel like a minority. When I came to this country, I was expected to behave as a minority and know my place. And I did not know how to acquiesce to that. So when people would put me down, when people would put me in my place, I would look at them as like, what's wrong with you? My GMAT scores are probably just as good as yours, if not better. And guess what? This university, you know, gave me a scholarship to get here all the way from India. So I must be pretty darn good at something. But part of it is it's more about the eyes through which they see you. And later in life, I've realized how much more difficult it is for somebody who's Black, born and raised in this country, generations of being put down. What must that be like? And the other piece I always used to say was, people looked at me, you're from India. Oh, you must be good at science and math. You know, they give you the benefit of the doubt. They give you that advantage of thinking you're smart till you prove them otherwise. there are other communities that do not get that same break. They are not thought of as, oh, you're smart, you're good at this. They make all those assumptions about us. So I would say to you, every community has something that we bring to the table that is our superpower, our innate strength, our competitive advantage. I'm going to say use it. And the other thing is, the other day I met on a Zoom call a Navy admiral who said, you know, she's one of three, you know, the three-star Navy admirals. And she was talking about her career and her life. And one of the things she said is, do you know I'm barely 5 feet tall? They underestimate me every time. She's a white woman. And she says, guess what? That's my superpower, that I'm short, that you don't expect certain things of me, but I can run circles around you. So I would say to you, similarly, we need to do the same thing. And I think that that's some of what I learned early. The other advantage I had was my first job was as a commodities trader. And what was great about that was every day, every week, every month, every year, I was judged based on the numbers I put up. So if my trading was good and I made money for the company and the client, I was gold. And if I didn't, I was crap. But it didn't matter that I was an Indian woman with an accent and frizzy hair.
Right.
It only mattered that I was good. So I think that in some ways, I thought I was very lucky in that I chose that as my early profession. And it gave me added confidence when I became a wealth advisor at Merrill Lynch and I started to face all of the bias with people hanging up because they didn't understand my accent or coming in to open an account with me and deciding that they didn't want to do business with a non-white woman. All of those biases, but by the time I faced those, I had already had so much confidence and self-assurance from success as a commodities trader, from growing up in a majority population, that I had enough gumption to put up with it. But I think to myself, what if somebody doesn't have that early experience and you get treated differently, put down, shut out, hung up on? All of those things can be demoralizing. And so when you wonder, why are there not enough financial advisors who are people of color or women, I'll tell you why. That's because we've been shut down enough and somewhere we didn't have that reserve of self-assurance and self-confidence and success that you could draw from to say, I think you're wrong. I'm pretty good. You know, if you don't have that in your past, then what do you draw on? What do you do with that?
So true.
And I think what I want to highlight, Subha, and this is absolutely is the key to the success, is that you have be authentic, be true to yourself, have confidence in your ability to do what you do really, really good, which is what you did, right? Being that commodities trader, you were good at that. And then after that, nothing mattered, whether you were a woman or an Asian woman or something else, didn't matter.
Varsha, it still hurt when people put you down. Yeah. I remember I was a wealth advisor at Merrill. There was a event at a club in Philadelphia. And in the last minute, they realized that I was the only non-white person that had actually won whatever it was for that evening. And they realized that that club did not admit women.
Oh, mm-hmm.
You couldn't go there. There was a meeting. The way they did it was, you can go there for a social event, but not a business event. And I've forgotten the name of the club, but somewhere I have to go back and dig that up to see if they've changed. But the reality was, ultimately, the company had to make the decision that they asked all of the spouses to come. And my spouse came, but he was a male, and I was the only woman in that group, and we all got to go. But, you know, literally, my spouse had to be the one pretending like he was the one that won it, and I was going along.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, this is not that long ago. I'm talking about probably the late 80s, early 90s. So it's not that long ago.
Right.
That's sad. That's sad. All right. So let me continue our conversation about diversity a little bit more. Subha, I think there is some notion of companies are trying to do a lot of things, right? Especially the big ones who have money. They have diversity programs. They have leadership programs for women. But oftentimes women, especially women who are in the middle management, and especially the ones that we work with a lot at Wings for Growth, they feel it's a lot of checking the box activity. They just want to show they're doing it, but they really don't mean it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Is there some truth to it? And if it is, what should they be doing?
It's a mixed bag. I would say to you that, you know, from my seat as the CEO of an organization that is working with these companies to create more inclusive environments for their working parents and caregivers, for their women and women of color, and for other dimensions of diversity, I usually lead with saying, what is your accountability metrics? Every quarter, you're going to ask, even every month, maybe you're asking your direct reports what the numbers look like. What are the revenues? What are the expenses? What is the contribution? So the question is, do you ask them the same for your diversity initiatives? And if not, why not? I think ultimately accountability will be the solution. It is rare that a CEO fails year after year in delivering against their goals and targets and still keeps his job. Okay, most likely after a year or two, he's fired. So from that perspective, I would say, you know, there should be the same kind of accountability as it relates to diversity and inclusion metrics. Who did you recruit? Who did you develop? Who did you promote? Who have you sponsored? Who have you mentored? What has the result been? Not just that you did that and check the box and say, I had a mentoring program, I had a sponsorship program, and we did that. But really, what are the results from it? And if it hasn't worked, how are you retooling it? What are you doing differently? If you go to the same places to recruit and you get a certain kind of result, what are you doing differently to get a different result? So I think that leaders holding themselves accountable and holding others accountable is really what is going to start making the change, because it'll cascade down. If the CEO does it, guess what his next level leader is going to do? He's going to hold the next level accountable and the next level and the next level. So I believe that there are two things that every employee in every organization should think is in their job description. One is being a recruiter on behalf of the company. I think everybody should say, I should bring good talent to my company, which means if you are Black, if you are Hispanic, if you are Asian, if you are, you know, LGBTQ, you should, in your network will be other great people who look like you. It is your job to bring them to the table, introduce them to the firm. Mm-hmm. Firm then needs to have the process that actually accepts them, brings them and hires them, develops them and promotes them. So that's one, being a recruiter on behalf of the firm. The second one is you have to be a brand ambassador or a salesperson for the firm. You need to be able to articulate what is so special about your company that customers should come do business with you. And in my opinion, if every employee can be made to think like that and you evolve a culture where people innately do that, you're going to have such a winning organization.
That's very, very true. Like, I'll give you an example, Zuba. We're working with a company. I won't name the names because we're still working with them. We are asking, they want to do this mentorship and leadership development program for women, which is great. It's a good step for them. And we asked if the senior leaders should sign up to be mentors. And these are MDs and EVPs of the company. More than 60-70% men in the leadership, they're saying, oh, I don't really have the time, but I can find someone in my team who can become a mentor, right? So that kind of actions really gives a message, right? That if you're not, and I think that's where they, you can spend $100,000 in a program like this, but if you're not going to take accountability and take the first step forward for this and set up an example, women are going to feel this is nothing. It's just a check the box activity.
I agree with you completely, completely.
Love action there that everyone can take. Subha, just pivoting slightly, you are such an amazing inspiration to so many people. You know, just even in this conversation, there's so many things that, you know, we all are can get inspired by. And as you look at your leadership journey, you had tremendous success on Wall Street. You had from very early on, then you made the shift to becoming the president of Working Mother Media. Would love to hear more about your leadership journey. But as you talk about that, even on your personal side, you have fought several battles. You are a 6-time cancer survivor. And in spite of all these obstacles, you've been extremely successful at work. And you've also nurtured and raised a beautiful family, 2 wonderful kids. How did you do it all? And, you know, who inspired you to be who you are today while you have been yourself a great inspiration to several people?
I have to tell you, my big inspiration were my mother, my grandmother. My grandmother only had an 8th grade education. This is somebody that if she had had the chance to go to university, she would have arm wrestled Indira Gandhi for that job as prime minister. She was that. Wow. She could have been a corporate CEO. But, you know, opportunities weren't there. And I often talk about how subsumed in me is generations of women in my family who never got the opportunity to be very much, you know, more than what was expected of them, being a good daughter, a good wife, a good mother, and a good grandmother. My mother was the first person in her extended family to be able to go to university. It used to be that till my mother's generations, till her actually, every girl, as soon as she hit puberty, would be married off. In my grandmother's generation, it was even earlier, obviously. My mother and father were promised to each other by their families. Obviously, it would have happened right after my mother hit puberty. My father was 7 years older than her. And she had wanted to go to university. She wanted to get an undergraduate degree. And my father insisted. He said he would only marry a girl who had a degree. And as a result of that, my mother was sent to university. So she was the first girl in our extended family. My grandmother is one of 10. In that whole family with dozens of cousins, my mother was the first girl to go and complete university. And they got married on the day she got her results. She was a valedictorian. She was university first. So she was really smart. And my father was in his own way an enormous feminist. They had a car when they were living in Calcutta when I was born. And he insisted that she learn how to drive. So he says, you can drop me off at the office and you can take the car for the day. You can come and pick me back up in the evening. Like, that is, and insisted that she get driving lessons to learn how to drive. So he was in many ways a pioneer in terms of what he thought women could and should do. Mm. And my mother was a homemaker, and then she became a teacher, really always wanted her daughters. There are two of us and my brother. He's the youngest and I'm the oldest. She was very, very particular that we all had our own financial independence. That was really important to her. So it wasn't just about getting a good education to make a good marriage. It was about having financial independence and autonomy. She thought that that was really important. So she has been my inspiration. She lives with me now. She's 82 and she's remarkable, you know, amazingly disciplined, well-read. During COVID, she learned Sanskrit. She learned a new language. So she's quite the rock star in my books. But in that journey, my career journey, obviously, I came to this country. I met my husband in business school. We got married. We have two children. My daughter is 32. My son is 25. My daughter is a surgeon in Tampa, and my son works at Moody's in New York. You know, I would say to you that one of the wisest decisions that you make as a career woman is who you choose to marry. That's really important. Mm-hmm. So I would say to you, whoever you choose wisely. Okay. Because that's the person who's either going to support you or who's going to derail you. So choose wisely. And I'm grateful that I chose really, really wisely. The second one is instinctively, I was very lucky that in my early job, I didn't depend on my boss liking me to decide on how much I got paid. I got paid a percentage of what I brought in. So that is a very liberating experience. And in some ways, I would say to you, I always encourage women to try for sales jobs, early career. Find a way to take a role that makes you responsible for revenues or be in the front lines where you are actually reaching out and connecting to customers. Okay. So that gives you a reality check on how your company makes money. And it is really good to get to know that. Even if you only do it for 6 months to a year, I think that everybody should have a rotation through sales. That's my personal belief, or sales support, or do something where you are touching that frontline customer. The other part of it is, you know, with that as a backdrop, I would tell you that work-life balance in many ways is a myth. And I say it's a myth because there are some times you should be prioritizing your home. And there are some times you should be prioritizing your work. What you need is the wisdom to know what to do when.
Yes.
I have never been able to do it all the time. Just doesn't work. And the times when I actually tried to do it all the time, where I was running a branch office, managing my own, you know, $2.5 billion book of business, having two young children at home. And my husband had a very successful career at that time, supporting him, doing it all. Guess what gave way? My health. And I faced my first bout with cancer in 1997. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma. My son was not even two at that time. So I have survived a long time. And I will tell you, that was my body saying, you know what, you're putting me last. So guess what, I'm going to put you last. And it came back again in 2000, again in 2002. I had a stem cell transplant, then again in 2004, 2007, and then 2013. So I've had multiple bouts with this. But I would say to you that what women often do, more often women than men, is their desire to have that career, to have the children and take care of them, they put themselves last. And I would say to you, that was my big aha lesson. As you look at work-life balance, I would say there are times when it's okay to have a nanny at home. It's okay not to be making the baked cookies to send it to school with your children. It's okay to buy cookies and put it on a nice doily and sending it with them. It's okay at work to say, I'm going to reschedule this meeting because my child has an important performance and I want to be there. It's okay to do that. I just think, you know, women need a certain amount of self-assurance and courage, and knowing that if I'm good enough at what I do, they'll reschedule that meeting.
Yeah.
It's not, but your child's that one performance will not happen again.
Yeah.
So, you know, choose wisely what it is that you spend time on.
You're listening to the Showing Up as a Leader podcast, hosted by Wings for Growth. If you're ready to take the leap and build your wings on your way up, sign up for our leadership development program at www.wingsforgrowth.org.
I want this conversation to be nonstop for another. I also want to just break a little bit and do a fun thing with the rapid fire. All right. So you're ready for that, Suba?
Yes.
Okay, let's go. So your favorite book?
Is Snow in August. It's a book by a sports writer called Pete Hamill. And it's an amazing story about, it's during, I think, World War II or World War I. It's about a rabbi from Eastern Europe that comes into Brooklyn. And there is an Irish boy in Brooklyn who's getting bullied. Wow. And how each of them help each other, even though this rabbi doesn't speak English. And this is a young boy and this is an older man, and how they support and help each other. It's an amazing story. It's one of my favorites.
Another one I haven't read yet. Your favorite leader?
My favorite leader right now is Ken Frazier. He's the CEO of Merck. He's somebody that I really look up to and respect. If you had asked me a few years ago, it would have been Roy Vagelos, who used to be the ex-CEO of Merck. But Ken Frazier has shown such uncommon courage in the way he has stood up, how he has spoken about it. I think he epitomizes leadership.
Awesome. Your favorite TV show?
This is going to give away a little other side of me. I love the Love It or List It show, which is that home rebuilding show.
Oh, yes.
I know it's corny, but I find it so calming.
Fair enough. Your favorite vacation spot, Suba?
Paris.
Yes. Favorite drink?
This again is going to give away the Indian side of me. Fresh lime and soda.
Yeah.
Every now and then I can throw in some gin into it.
I thought you were going to say masala chai.
Well,
well, fair enough. That's good too. All right. Favorite color? I usually like to ask white or black. And look at this. Looks like three of us are wearing black today, and you have a little bit of white.
Yeah.
But what's your favorite color?
Mine is, I like black because it is awfully slimming.
Okay.
Reason.
All right. And the last one, your favorite leadership quote.
This is so strange. You would think that I'm copying it from you, but it is JFK's, a rising tide lifts all boats, is my favorite quote. I say it all the time. In fact, my team thinks I came up with it.
Well, I love that quote.
How serendipitous that Varsha chose that quote to start the podcast.
It's
amazing.
I was thinking to myself when she said it, I said to myself, oh my God, did she peer inside my head to figure out what I was going to say?
All right. So we do have two more questions, Suba. And one of this is, I think that this one is very, very important. I think we should really talk about this, that I often hear that women need to help women a lot more. especially when it comes to uplifting. I want to know what your thoughts are, and specifically share with us, how are you doing that in your career and life?
That's a really important question. I fundamentally believe that women, you know, there's this whole sort of, it's not a myth that women really are like crabs. They pull other women down. They're competitive. They're, you know, I think that that may have been true a couple of generations ago in the workplace, but I do not believe it is true now. I think women are supportive of each other. Women have understood the power of collaboration, of coming together. So I will start off with that and say, there are so many ways in which women can support each other. I think when it comes to mentoring, we've always had this image that it has to be somebody senior or older than you that mentors you and supports you. I think that there is peer mentoring. Your subordinates can mentor you. This notion of mentoring is about giving thoughtful guidance and advice, is about wishing you well. And that group of people that wishes you well should be all around you, below you, around you. So from that perspective, I think that this idea that women can actually mentor each other is powerful. One of my strongest mentors was actually my assistant. I don't know if you ever knew Nancy Santiago.
I do, yes.
I know. So Nancy, when she first joined us, she once said to me, she said, you know what? You've got to trust me to do the right thing for you. You cannot constantly, you know, if I'm the one that manages your calendar and schedules for you, you can't constantly go and schedule around me. You, in fact, you're not allowed to do that till you check in with me.
I see.
Because if you do your job and you do mine, you're obviously not doing your job well enough. And I have to tell you, that was ringing from an assistant. That has actually kept me constantly vigilant, looking for mentors all around me, as opposed to just looking at a certain sort of person who worked, right, who was a boss or who was senior or superior to me. So I have learned a lot from people around me. So in my own way, I try to be able to give back. So I do a lot of situational mentoring where I can't just be sort of a full-time mentor to someone, but they may come to me with a specific issue or challenge, and I can help them around that. I call that situational mentoring. I have mentored some people. There is one of my mentees who's now very, very successful at Merrill. Her name is Nadia Alauddin. And I met her when she was a rookie FA, and this was when I was beginning to build the multicultural business development unit at Merrill. And she was in a meeting in Los Angeles. And I remember she said to me, she said, when you came and you asked me about what I was doing, how I was doing, and took interest in me, my immediate thought was, what does she want from me? You know, so there's a suspicion that women have. And, you know, the only thing I wanted from her was I wanted to be able to help her because I didn't have anybody to help me. And I thought to myself, she's going to go through a lot of what I'm going to go through. I hope that I can be there for her so she doesn't have to go through the same thing. So I will tell you that the opportunity for women to mentor each other is powerful. And then there's sponsorship. You know, where and whenever you have the opportunity, look for good talent to sponsor. You notice people who are doing something well and you observe that, find that stretch assignment that you can pull them into. You know, speak up for them when they are not there in the room. And I think that when you practice that, it's almost like you create a ripple effect around you. When you do that, then guess what? Others are doing it for you. And it just continues to keep getting paid forward.
Yeah. Suba, I did mention this to you earlier too, is that it's not that you have to spend a lot of hours and spend a lot of time with someone. You and I didn't spend a lot of time together. We only talked a few times when we were at Merrill together. And I remember that you inspired me to have that huge Diwali function at Merrill, which used to be attended by 30 people. And then that year, it was 100 plus people who showed up for that event. And it was me and Bob Ng who organized it. So again, it's not really, you don't have to really spend a lot of time. And another point that you really mentioned, which is very important, that younger generation is much more aware about self-entitlements, authenticity, and being able to have control their own career. There's so much to learn from them. So what I want to do is just one more question I wanted to ask, which is, again, very important. You mentioned last time that showing up as a leader is a whole lot about how actually you show up in a room, right? Your body language, where you take a seat at the table, how do you command the room? Give us like some tips there.
I would lead off with when you go into a room and you notice that most of the seats are taken and there's only a few left, do not automatically sit on the seats on the side. Take your seat at the table, even if it is the last seat. And you know that somebody who's even more senior is coming later, doesn't matter. And if they do come and they expect somebody to move, better not let it be you. Do not get up and move from that table. Second, if you go into a room and there's open seats available and you're at this meeting, take a seat at the head of the table. Okay. And not only take a seat at the head of the table, the next 2-3 women who come in, invite them to come and sit with you. Strengthen numbers, okay? And don't sort of shrink down to take as little space as you can. Spread out, put your stuff there, put your, you know, I usually carry a notebook, so the notebook there, the pen there. It's okay to spread some materials on the side. And they may say, look at you and say, oh my God, she's taking up twice as much room. That's perfectly okay. Perfectly okay. And, you know, interestingly enough, the other thing that very often gets said is that a woman will come up with an idea, a man will then embellish that idea and it becomes his idea. You know what? Be that woman. If it's somebody else's idea that this man usurped, reach back and say, you know what? You know, Rupa, that was a great idea. And hey, John, that was really great, you know, that you added to it. Rupa, what else do you think you would? I mean, just make sure you throw that ball back to her. Think about it as almost like playing basketball where you're taking
and
it
amplify
back.
Amplify that.
Back.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. So you can do that. And if you do that for people, they will do it for you. So it really just grows. And you have to lead with a certain generosity of spirit, not about it's all about me, but it's really about it's about us. And if I bring people into it, they will bring me into whatever it is that they're doing.
That's true.
And it wins. And that's how a rising tide carries all boats up.
You know, yesterday, a guy friend of mine, I was talking to him and he was saying, Varsha, I like show up, but you should also say, don't just show up, stand out.
Yes.
He said that. And I was thinking, oh, you know, maybe we should have made that as the name of the podcast. All right. So it's a wrap. Let's do one more last question. This is our signature question. Suba, 2021 will be an interesting year. What's your advice to women leaders who are ready to take the leap and build their wings on the way up?
I would say to you, firstly, you know, you've said this a number of times, be authentic, be your real self. You know, I used to often hear it be said, you know, be yourself because everybody else is taken. So when you want to be just like someone else, you have to settle to being second best. So be authentic, be bold, be collaborative, be empathetic, be vulnerable, yet be decisive. Don't be afraid. And my husband says this to me, and I laugh at it when he does. He says, sometimes wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, have the courage of conviction. If you believe in something, go for it. Put it out there. You may be wrong. You may get pushed back. But if you never ask, the answer is always no.
Yes, very true. Because you never asked. Wow. I don't know, Rupa, about you, but I almost feel like I don't want to let Suba go to enjoy her beautiful day in Florida.
I have another meeting. Otherwise, I would stay. I promise you.
No, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much for doing this. And I know this is going to be so useful and inspiring for not just me and Rupa, but all our listeners.
Fascinating, refreshing, and inspiring, Suba. Thank you. You're being very generous with your time and the insights you've shared.
Well, Rupa, I'm grateful. And Varsha, any time for you. I'm proud of you. I'm amazed at what you've accomplished and what you continue to accomplish. And really looking forward to seeing, you know, you spread your wings out even more.
You paved the path for us, which I'm walking on. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for tuning in. We wish you the best as you take the learnings from this podcast and strive to show up as a leader in all those moments, situations, and interactions where you can make a difference. Build your wings and sign up to be part of the Wings program at www.wingsforgrowth.org.